welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio. Today's featured guest, Nick Barishev. It's a pleasure to welcome Nick Barishev back to the show, President CEO of Bullion Management Group, BMG, widely recognized as an international bullion expert and written extensively on the topic, not to mention $10,000 gold. That's music to aficionados' ears, convinced, as are many of our guests, the yellow metal is undervalued. Welcome back, Nick Barishev.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Talking before the show about some of the more interesting speeches and things that you've been working on lately, and you spoke before the Empire Club. Tell us more, please.
Well, yeah, it's an annual event that I've spoken at seven times in the past, and it's to do with market outlook for the year held in the first week of January. So this year's theme, the title is called A Tactical Opportunity, Sell High, Buy Low, which is sort of play on words from buy low, sell high. But the main point is that there's an opportunity now. Many people have been invested in the financial markets, particularly U.S. equities, and that they've done well since the bottom in 2008. But that, you know, in my view, that's now over. We're peaking, and all the indicators, without getting into all the economic factors driving this, if we just look at the results. And one of them, there's three major indicators that I cited in my speech, which is the Buffett indicator, the Shiller PE, and the Tobin Q ratio. Now, those look at whether stocks are overvalued or undervalued and so on. Now, the Buffett one takes the Dow, the entire U.S. market cap divided by the U.S. GDP. And whenever it goes over 100, that means stocks are overvalued, and below, they're undervalued. So when we look at the previous peaks, it was 153 in 2000 and 106 in 2007. So today we have it sitting at 123. So in each case, we've had a crash following the overvaluations over the 100, and in both cases over 50%. Shiller price earnings ratio is the other indicator. It's a very long term indicator. And on that, you look at it was 32 in 1929. It was 44 in 1999, and 27 in the 2007 period. So it's now 25, where the average is 16.7. So this is indicating like 55% overvalued. And again, we're looking at a 50% correction to get it back to the average. Now, the Tobin Q ratio measures market value versus replacement cost. And the norm is about 0.7. And we had 1.6 in 2000, 0.9 in 2007. And now again, we've got 1.1, which is 58% overvalued. So forgetting about what's causing this and all in terms of all the economic indicators, it's clear that when you look at these main measurements, that stock prices in the U.S. are at least 50% overvalued. And that's how much the crash would be. Now, typically, when markets crash, they overshoot the average, so you're likely to see below that. So my point in this was, now is the opportunity to sell high and take, redistribute the profits and buy low. And gold is what we have as highly undervalued right now and poised to increase dramatically. I think we formed a bottom We've been hovering in these numbers for quite some time now, and things are starting to move. The main thing I looked at, which people forget because the sentiment is very low in gold, there's been a media barrage of negative articles, gold's going to $500, all this kind of thing. But the same thing happened in the 1970s, and one of my advantages, I was old enough to actually remember the 1970s. And in 1970, gold went from $35 an ounce in 1971 to $200 by 1974. Then it corrected 45% to $100. And that's when most investors threw the towel. I never want to hear about gold. I don't never invest in it again. It's never going anywhere. The media was full of negative articles. And then from that low in 1976, it went up 750% in about 3 years. And I think about the same thing is going to happen now.
But, you know, there is some precedent, I think, recent precedent for just such an ascent. For instance, we watched silver in 2010 advance from roughly $14 to about 50 an ounce in just 9 months' time. Keep in mind, that's not a monetary play there. Silver is rarely viewed, although many of us disagree with that standpoint. Gold is typically viewed as the de facto alternative reserve currency. Should we see any type of currency dislocation, as many people are calling for, the IMF now accepting the yuan in its basket of global reserve currencies? I mean, this is a sea change event.
The actual implications of that haven't happened yet. They've approved the yuan for inclusion in the basket, and the current allocation is at a 10.9% ratio. But the implementation of it only starts in September. Now, the thinking is that there's a very complicated formula that calculates what the percentage allocation that each country's currency has in the SDR. And one of the factors is gold reserves. Now, China is not accepting an allocation as low as 10.9%. They're the second largest economy in the world. So 10.9% doesn't make sense as an SDR allocation. Now, the thing is, China has been accumulating gold, and many people have looked at that and believe that the amounts that they've actually accumulated is in excess of 5,000 tons, where they're only reporting a bit over 1,000 tons. So before the implementation of the yuan in the fall, they're likely to announce their true gold holdings, and the true gold holdings are currently being held in the sovereign wealth fund, which doesn't report to anybody. So the gold is going to get transferred from the sovereign wealth fund to the central bank, and then they're going to look for an adjustment in the SDR to a higher than a 10.9% allocation. When that happens, the problem becomes, well, not a problem, but the questions that become is, where did China get their 5,000 tons? Because according to all the reporting services, GFMS and CPM, everything's being accounted for. So where did that 5,000 tons come from? Well, the thing they don't account for is leased gold.
That throws a wrench into this complex formula.
Problem then becomes is if the gold that's being leased ended up in China, well, that's never coming back. And that means that the leases have come from the Western central banks. And what the Western central banks are reporting as their gold holdings is not, in fact, accurate, since they've got IOUs for the leases instead of physical bullion.
You pointed out the implications haven't really been felt yet. I mean, it's almost like there's been a Category 10 or a earthquake. The reverberations have not yet really traveled.
It's not just the SDR. Like, the issue, there's been several kind of moves by the Chinese, and the intent is to eliminate the kind of the privilege the U.S. has had as the world's reserve currency. So, for example, and unless you connect all these dots, the media is hardly reporting on them individually, let alone in total. So China has signed 26 currency swap agreements with different countries. So in the past, when China and, say, the other trading partner settled trade imbalances, they settled in U.S. dollars. So under these swap agreements, they will settle in their own currency, whether it's the yuan or whatever it's the countries involved. So there's 28. So it's almost all the major countries in the world have already signed this deal. So the U.S. dollar is no longer used for those trade settlements. They've created an Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank that is an alternative to the IMF in terms of providing loans to BRIC countries. In Canada, they've set up a yuan currency exchange hub with the ICBC Bank of China, which is the largest bank in China. They've already developed and implemented an alternative to the SWIFT system, which is what's used to transfer currencies internationally. And Russia is in the process of developing their own version as well. And then that's Chinese acceptance. Now, the last thing that's going to have a direct impact on the gold price is that the Shanghai Gold Fix is to be implemented in the spring of 2016. Now, this is going to be a direct competitor to the COMEX, but it is going to be for physical only. And there's five banks from the LBMA group and 15 banks from China that are going to be setting the fix. So it'll be very unlikely that there's any playing around happen there. Secondly, because it's physical only, the issue will be if on the COMEX you get these naked short sales that we've had over the past 3 years, then they're instantly going to be arbitraged in Shanghai. And it'll become very unprofitable to do that. So that will stop this intervention on the COMEX, which is one of the main depressors of the gold price.
Of course, we've also seen quite an interesting development with the Shanghai Gold Exchange in that there is such an interesting offtake there that the exchange actually performs as a precious metals exchange should. It actually delivers.
That's a physical, yeah. You can only deal in physical. Where here, you've got, you know, COMEX inventories are at an all-time low. There's something like 300 ounces of paper gold to every 1 ounce of physical. And that's like a catastrophe waiting to happen.
You touched on the equities markets, the mainline media's focus, but then there's also a market that's three times as large, of course, that's debt. We've watched high-yield bond market implode as yields soar, and of course with the Fed threatening another at least 100 basis points on the upside likely in 2016, perhaps even a bit more, according to the Fed funds futures rates, doesn't bode well for debt. And debt seems to have been the engine, but a primary component to this 6 or 7 year run in equities, because inexpensive debt allows corporate treasurers and CFOs to buy back their shares on the open market. And of course, this increases demand and boosts the share price. But with debt becoming more and more expensive and difficult to procure, that might actually not be just what people need to hear. Do you worry at all that we might see a deflationary episode, or at least disinflationary period, that takes everything down with it, just as we've seen crude oil implode and stocks and maybe even bonds?
First of all, I don't worry about it because I'm, you know, primarily in invested in gold. And what people don't realize is that gold performs better in an actual deflation than an inflation. And there's a very in-depth study by a fellow called Jastrom that looked at that over 300 years. And it sounds counterintuitive, like how can gold perform? But you measure gold in terms of purchasing power. So, for example, what happens in a deflation? Let's say real estate goes down 70%. And gold goes down 25%. Well, what that means is the purchasing power of your gold relative to real estate is you can buy more real estate with your ounces. Doesn't matter what the dollar price is. So both of them can go down in dollar terms in a deflation, but in purchasing power terms, gold goes up.
Exactly. So you're looking at nearly a threefold, not quite a threefold, improvement in your overall purchasing power for your household.
That's where the important difference is. Now, in terms of a deflation, the true definition of inflation or deflation is an increase or a contraction in money supply. So obviously we've had an increase in money supply through the Fed. And when markets implode, when debt gets default, and at this point we're looking at sovereign debt default possibility, those are all deflationary. But then what we have to look at is we go back to Bernanke's speech where he talked about there will be no deflation because the Fed can avoid it. They will, if it takes throwing money out of helicopters, then they'll do that. So the problem is that when they get a risk of deflation and they get nervous, they're going to print more money like we've never seen to avoid and to counteract the deflation. And that's when you get inflation and subsequently hyperinflation.
And I know that our listeners are going to appreciate that. And I'm actually going to make sure we write this up with your interview because I want everyone to really mull that over and digest the significance of it. Because we have guests on the show who like to point out that during the Great Depression, you know, gold lost some value. Your point that, you know what, that's okay because everything lost much more.
See, what you've got to always measure is you take and measure things in ounces. How many ounces did it take to buy a house, a car, the Dow, whatever? So that's where it comes down. It doesn't matter what the price of gold is in a paper currency that's fluctuating all over the place. It's how many ounces does it take to buy a house? How many ounces does it take to invest in the Dow? That's when you get the true measure of it.
That requires some gray matter. It's a little bit more than a cursory overview or a 30-second soundbite. You know, you talk about your lack of concern really about deflation because, you know, it really doesn't make sense. As you say, we look at the classical definition, the Keynesian perspective on deflation, and, well, come on. We've seen this massive monetary printing. It's not stopping. It's actually accelerating in Europe and in many parts of Asia. In the United States, we claim that we're not. There's some big question marks there as well.
There's a difference, too, is... We would have deflation in financial assets, debt instruments, equity instruments. We can have, that's what we're having right now, okay? But in terms of inflation and what people think of inflation, the stuff you have to buy at the grocery store to eat your home, to, you know, pay your medical bills, to pay your taxes, that's going to be still rising. So what we're going to have is an anomaly in that we've got deflation in financial assets. Now, they never called that inflation when those financial assets were rising. But right now, what we'll have is deflation because when decline, money effectively vaporizes and disappears. So, but at the same time, the true cost of living, you're probably aware of John Williams' shadow stats, we're running at about 8%. And you know, not what government concocted CPI is. So we've got a problem where we've got the real cost of living in terms of stuff we have to, you know, buy day to day is going to be going up, and on the other hand, financial assets are going to be imploding.
There are interesting GDP numbers. When they adjust the gross domestic product by the true inflation rate that you've discussed, we have been in a full-scale recession since the year 2000, a 16-year recession. And I can say, and maybe I'm just an anomaly here, I've felt that just judging by friends, colleagues, coworkers, there was a title change in the year 2000, and we just haven't gotten back on track unless you're one of the 0.1% for the typical middle class and working class individual. Recession has just become a way of life.
That's confirmed by some other factors. Is that when we look at the, you know, the participation rate which is now in the same place it was in 1978, and it's at like 62. The thing is, that means the balance, 38%, aren't working. Mention the food stamps, the increase in the food stamps. So if the economy is doing well, then people are coming off food stamps and the participation rate is rising, not falling.
You're echoing the sentiments of Dr. Burton Malkiel at Princeton, who brought up the exact same points you have. The participation rate is abysmal. It's emblematic of a highly ill economy. Unfortunately, there's not a quick panacea that our officials are likely to, you know, implement.
Because since before 2000, we've been exporting jobs and manufacturing in the U.S. and Canada has all been declining and being exported around the world. And new jobs haven't been taking place, nor is there enough demand. Like there's demand for high technology jobs, but in total there's not very many of them, and the people that are trying to find employees can't find them. So you've got anomalies there. The only place where they're growing, you can't find the people, and so on. So you've got a big transitional problem to overcome, just in terms of the way it's structured. If ultimately that the price of oil rises again, which it inevitably will, and a transportation costs get too high, and U.S. multinationals start bringing manufacturing home, they'll bring it home but implement with robots, and there won't be any, you know, people working.
Another favorite on our show, Dr. Stephen Lieb from New York. We really see eye to eye on this idea that we've got to stop complaining and whining about how we've exported a 500,000 high-paying industrial jobs per year and really accept the fact that we've entered a new world. And then this idea of robotics is fascinating because up to 50% of the current jobs, 2016, 2015, that we see today will be replaced within the next decade or sooner by robotics. And here's a quick example. Why do you need 12 people to make that burger and package those French fries when it can very easily, remotely, you can swipe your card at the drive-through, those French fries and a sandwich, perfectly made, no human hairs, unadulterated by mankind, in a fraction of the time?
Breaks, no vacations, no time off, 24/7. But that's going to be a huge transitional problem.
I think you brought up another quandary that we're facing, this huge amount of debt. We started to go down this route, and I'd like to finish up with it. And, you know, we're looking at our five or six major money center banks here in North America who have taken on a little extra debt. According to some of the figures, we're looking at roughly $250 to $300 trillion in notional derivative. These numbers start to numb one's mind. When you talk about these numbers, $300 trillion, the national gross domestic product for a year, can this be sustained? And if, you know, even one domino starts to fall in the financial sector, what type of cascade effect might that have?
That's been the problem in it, and we didn't learn anything in 2008. It's now everything has gotten worse since 2008, not better. And no lessons have been learned, and we're going to do the same thing, but it'll be times 10 this time around. That's the problem. And we've got, you know, we saw a taste in terms of what happens in an implosion in Cyprus and Greece. So that was like the canary in the coal mine. So that's now happening in countries all over the world. South America's the giant disaster. Most of the former tax haven islands in the Caribbean are economically like Greece or Cyprus, and it's, you know, filtering all over the world in terms of the commodity producer countries are all having a tough time, and in most cases the debt is denominated in U.S. dollars, which have risen. So we're going to have multiple sovereign debt defaults, and that could very well be cascading. When you get to the U.S., the thing is, when you add up all the current cash debt and the unfunded liabilities, it comes out to about $1 million per taxpayer.
That's about four times what we typically read in the blogosphere. You've got an interesting metric here. Could you maybe break it down for our listeners?
There's, like, if we take roughly $18 trillion of cash debt, but when we talk about unfunded liabilities, that's another $122. If your readers go to the U.S. debt clock it's interactive and, you know, running all the time, and it will show you the all the components of the debt and what it translates to per person, per taxpayer, per household. All that's on the U.S. Debt Clock website.
Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff, a regular here from Boston University, underscored and highlighted just what you pointed out. In fact, that's, you might say, one of his biggest points, although he's been giving us great tips on for Social Security and disability lately. The Inform Act, big proponent there. He has something like 17 Nobel laureates who have signed, and anyone listening to our voice can. But I think that he really brings home everything you've just brought up. When the true tally, as you say, unfunded liabilities, this is just an enormous sum. I will say that you're the first to bring up roughly $1 million per person.
Per taxpayer, because only about 50% of the people are taxpayers.
What if one were to become financially independent?
I'm not sure, because this is already, you know, for instance, in the U.S., the Social Security system is somewhat different than Canada. When wages are deducted and the money is paid into Social Security, that goes into the, you know, general government pot. So they pay out Social Security from that and spend whatever is left over. So, you know, it's they've been in a position where they've been spending the excess instead of investing it. In Canada, when we take our Canada Pension Plan contributions, those are invested. We can talk about whether they're the best investments, but they're at least invested. They're not simply, you know, purchasing government T-bills with them. And where you get the thing is, the way the U.S. does their financial statements is not according to generally accepted accounting principles, because if a public corporation has unfunded pension liabilities, that shows up in terms of their annual income statement. So if you did that in the U.S., the annual deficit would be something in the order of $5 to $6 trillion instead of what they're proposing as a deficit. That's the cash deficit, not the accrued deficit in terms of the current year's amount. So when you look at, you know, an economy, a $5 to $6 trillion deficit is almost half of the entire GDP.
We had that wake up moment. We've had several rehypothecations. We've even had MF Global, which seems is off everybody's radar screen today. The writing is on the wall. We've had the warning shot across the bow. We've got to start thinking in terms of no liens against your investments. When I start to think about how stocks, who owns the stocks? Is it some corporation somewhere? Is it a holding company? Is it the Federal Reserve?
That's a whole other long discussion, because, you know, whether it's client margin accounts or most mutual funds and so on, the brokers in many cases are the authorized participants to ETFs. And, you know, whether their equities or gold are lent to an ETF. So then they're shorted, and through the shorting process, again, rehypothecated and so on. So you have, you know, multiple claims on the same assets. So that this whole ETF Ponzi scheme is one day going to end very, very badly.
And we've already seen signs of the unraveling there with the investigations by policymakers and authorities starting to recognize that these rollover fees and related expenses and expense ratios are exorbitant. It's just smoke and mirrors. Who really owns what? And there's another interesting aspect here. If you look at the fine print on, for instance, Street Tracks, I think that's the largest, at least North American gold ETF, at least it was at one point. Only folks with investments of roughly, I think it's $1 million, it might be $100,000, but it's a huge sum, have any potential leverage getting their funds, you know, any type of delivery of gold. And even that is questionable.
You'd have to be, if you're a very large investor, you still couldn't redeem. You'd have to do it through an authorized participant. And it's only the authorized participants that have signed agreements and get the ability to contribute baskets or redeem them. So presumably if they redeemed a basket on behalf of a very large investor, you could get delivery of that gold. But that's the only way I know of getting physical bullion, you know, out of the ETF. The main concern is that the bullion that's sitting in the ETF has been borrowed ultimately from the central banks and is just parked there.
Yeah, how many times has that been leased and rehypothecated itself?
Technically, when a central bank leases gold, you know, in a bizarre way, the gold remains the property of the central bank, just like with any other lease. The lessee can sell the gold, and he just promises to return equal bars.
Ah, naked shorting. How interesting.
An anomaly. So the thing is that if the ownership is still at the central bank, at the ETF, and something goes wrong with the authorized participant, the central banks are going to ask for their gold back or demand their gold back.
I like how you put that, ask for their gold back, at gunpoint. Right?
Lawyers don't get rich. That's the growth opportunity.
Since obviously there appears to be some exciting opportunity developing, markets can't stay depressed forever. With all this concern about whether or not you own an ETF, all the legislation that's being written under the fine print, we just don't know whether we own it or who owns it and what's going on. Wouldn't it be nice to have some physical gold? So tell us a bit about bullion. Give us an idea of opportunities for every level investor, the novice, the neophyte, all the way to the expert investor.
Yeah, I guess the starting point for the small investors are silver bullion coins, and whether they're, you know, this is, you know, U.S. gold eagles or Canadian maples, that kind of thing. The thing to do is just buy the simple bullion coins and not numismatics or even semi-numismatics, just pure bullion coins. That's the easiest place to start. Past that, like in we have our two mutual funds, which are primarily for Canadian retail registered retirement savings account, where as money comes in, we just, you know, buy bullion as required. And then for large credit investors, we have a program where we sell them the actual, you know, large LBMA bars, and we provide storage either with the Bank of Nova Scotia or through Brinks all over the world. We have storage facilities with Brinks in Canada, Hong Kong, Singapore, Dubai, Switzerland, Panama. So we arrange that for our investors that buy the physical bullion. And we have a, you know, variety of choices. So that for U.S. investors, it would be the bullion that would make the most sense. The way to do it would be to buy it and store it with Brinks and, you know, wherever you choose around the world.
Let's talk a bit about $10,000 gold. This is your magnum opus. I have at least one or two copies here already, so we appreciate that, and it's just must-read material for all of our listeners, all of whom are aficionados. So please tell us a bit more. I know that this is a labor of love. I bet you wouldn't recommend writing and going through the process for most people. Time-consuming, challenging endeavor. But tell us more about $10,000 gold, please.
That was the first book in Like you say, it took a long time to write, 3 years, because I tried to make it so it's digestible to everybody. And it's a very complicated subject overall, so I've tried to simplify it, and I've received a lot of compliments that people were able to understand, you know, what I was saying in the book. I have been writing a sequel to it, which we hope to bring out later this year, which will update things. And really, the update that the path to $10,000 gold has actually improved. The conditions that I talk about in the $10,000 gold book have actually gotten worse, and the debt has gotten higher, and so on. So that premise of $10,000 gold still exists very much. Since I've written the book, there's many observers have come up with even higher predictions in $10,000 an ounce. Print enough money, you could reach them.
Exactly. And so there's really nothing to stop a 1-to-1 ratio on gold and the Dow. We've just seen it so many times. I don't know that specifically, maybe not 1-to-1, but in the general vicinity, as we look back over the decades and over the past 100 years. And if
we're very close to 1-to-1 in 1980.
This game may be only in the early innings. I mean, this is going to be quite a fascinating time. And we certainly hope that everybody listening to our voices today, you know, starts to take measures, make contingencies. It never hurts to have a safety net. And I can't think of a better safety net than bullion. Nick Barashev, oh wow, are we going to look forward to this new tome, hopefully in 2016. And those who haven't already, you've got to pick up a copy of $10,000 Gold. You can do it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookshop. Nick Barashev, that's BMG Group. You know, inform your neighbors, family, friends. Let's not drop the ball. Let's stay on top of this. Any parting comments today?
Like I said in the Empire Club speeches, if you're invested in equities, I think it's time to heavily rebalance and move those assets, or you're going to, you know, face a very painful 2016.
I'll bet there's probably a video up of the Empire Club speech.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, yeah.
We'll embed the video then, and we'll make sure that's embedded up on Goldseek. What a pleasure. I hope that you'll, you know, drop by a bit more frequently, and we're going to hear more from you in 2016.
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure.
Here is your mining quiz for the day, compliments of Goldseek. Which company has the largest undeveloped gold reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold. Now, which company has the largest undeveloped copper reserve in North America? Seabridge Gold again. Seabridge has more gold reserves than Kinross, Yamana, and Agnico Eagle. Last year alone, Seabridge added 515 million tons of new inferred resources containing nearly 6 million ounces of gold and more than 6 billion pounds of copper at their giant KSM project in British Columbia, Canada. Now they are drilling at KSM again with multiple rigs in a 25,000-meter program. Find out more by visiting www.seabridgegold.net. Traded on the NYSE, symbol SA, and the TSX, symbol SEA.
Goldseek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.